Elizabeth Marshall Thomas was one of the first Westerners to live amongst and study the Bushmen of the Kalahari. She later studied tribal life in Nigeria, lions in Namibia, and wolves on Baffin Island, as well as dogs in her own kitchen. She's written many books. You probably know her as the author of the bestseller, The Hidden Life of Dogs. She joins us now to discuss her latest book, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. Welcome, Liz.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for being here. Well, I'm so delighted to be able to talk with you today. Your book is really amazing, both in its observations and in its writing style. So thanks for joining us. Now, I know you've always loved watching and studying animals, and then you left college at 18 or 19 and went with your family to live in Africa.
Yes, we did.
Tell us about how that expanded your views on observing animals.
Well, it was a fabulous gift. The people had to live by the rules of the natural world, and had done so for 200,000 years. But everything else that lives in the natural world has to do the same thing. So it was an insight into the natural world, the like of which is very hard to imagine. The people you could interview. You can't interview a tree or an animal. And the problems are very much the same. And the things they must do are the things they must, rules of nature that they must observe are all the same. So it was very educational.
What are some of your most memorable recollections of that time, that first time that you went there? Will you share a few with us?
Yes. The people were exceptionally good to us. They were supposed to be, they were said to be and believed to be dangerous. They would shoot us with poison arrows and so forth. And the people we met had only one person in the group had ever seen a white person before. That was when the Dorslan fur truckers went from South Africa to Angola, and they passed through the Kalahari. And that was one person and one view, but they'd heard about white people, and they nothing good. But even so, they welcomed us, and they agreed to talk with us. And they gave us names which put us into their kinship system so that we knew how to relate to everybody else. I mean, they couldn't have been more wonderful to us, and we were extremely grateful. Something very interesting about them was that they lived, the water sources were limited. There were only 8 in a 60,000 square mile area known as Nyanyai, and 8 permanent water holes and 7 impermanent, and each one had a population of people, bushmen, and lions living there because these are life forms that need to drink water. There was no surface water, and so not in the dry season. But the lions and the people had a kind of truce. The lions didn't prey on the people, which was extraordinary because everywhere else lions do prey and did prey on people. And I believe it was because of the water. But the lions would come and look at us sometimes, and that's, I like to remember those times very much.
I'm sure. Now, you did have some quite memorable encounters with lions.
Well, my brother and I saw, we were just walking through the veld, and we saw a male lion. What you're supposed to do if you see encounter a lion is to walk away in an oblique angle, pretending that you're not interested. But we were so awestruck that we just stood there, and the lion walked away in an oblique angle, pretending that he wasn't interested, which I thought was very interesting because evidently that's what you do. There was one lioness who came. She stood between the Bushman's encampment and our camp, which was a very short distance, and she stood there and roared and roared and roared. And we don't know what she was trying to tell us something, but we don't know what. And people just froze and hoped she'd go away, which she did. And another time we went somewhere where we hadn't been before and camped, and the lions of that area came and did choral roaring, which is a few lions roar at once and more lions join them. And when some run out of breath, others join in, so the roar is continuous. And deafening, and it travels about 5 miles. But they were right next to us, and I mean, I was scared, but they came to tell us to leave. That's what they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And did you?
Yeah.
Good thinking. What other sorts of animal encounters did you have there?
Oh, lots of them. Hyenas, the lions didn't prey on people, but leopards and hyenas did. And, I mean, a hyena would come and take a bite out of somebody. But the people had their shelters facing in every direction, so if a predator came into the encampment, someone would see it. So that wasn't so much trouble, but we didn't have the same arrangement, and I had a little backpacker tent, and I was in there reading by candlelight, and a hyena put his head in through the tent flap, and we just looked at each other, and I said, you know, what do you want? I think he came to see if I was maybe sick or asleep, and he saw that I wasn't. So he just left in a very polite manner. He just withdrew.
I love that
but
story.
That's what the natural world is like. We think it's raw in tooth and claw or whatever. Not at all.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're living there, it's such a part of it.
Yes, when you're part of it. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Speaking of your tent, I loved your whole book. I especially loved the passage where you talk about the joys of living in a tent, and I was wondering if you would read that for our listeners.
Oh, gladly. Okay. I was thinking that after you have lived in a tent and slept in a tent for night after night, a house seems as solid and dark as a cavern, part of another world. A tent is loose and waves about you, sifting into you through pale green fabric the light of the sun and the moon. A tent is many things in one, a shelter from the cold night and from the rain, which when it falls you can see the drops through the fabric, letting in shining light like drops of liquid on ground glass. A tent is a shade from the sun, or a place that catches the early morning sunlight and warms the air inside like an oven. In a tent, you can rig up the door piece so that it forms a little porch for you, a shade for your door. When you wake up in the morning, you see the sunlight shining in the tree roots right under your nose because you sleep on the ground. Or you look up at the sky through the doorway and see the stars or the sun rising right behind the sliver of the waning moon and smell the first wind that lifts before dawn, which blows right over you. A house has its own individual smells and signs and noises like a creature, and is a world within a world, stubbornly standing up to the sun and the rain, with its outside walls like a barricade, so that the inside climate is always the same, the ideal of the owners. But a tent is hot at noon and cold at night, bright by sunlight and pale in the moonlight, wet when the rain falls, and sighing, blowing, moving backwards and forwards with the wind. Because you sleep on the ground, you can hear things that walk past in the nighttime. The grass moves, and if the creature is big enough, you hear the footfalls, like those of the lions who came the other night. This you never get in a thick-walled house. I slept in a Bushman grass shelter and a Herero Rondeville, and they're pretty good, too, but I'll take a tent any time. My tent is only a disheveled, dilapidated old thing, worn thin by wind and sun and rain, but such is the sensation of living in it.
Thank you. That's such a wonderful ode to being in tents. Appreciate that.
Oh, thanks.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. She's an author, and she's joining us to talk about her most recent book, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. It's a memoir. So, Liz, how did the time that you spent in the Kalahari with your family as a teenager affect the way you approach the world afterwards?
Oh, I saw everything else forever after through the lens of that experience. I don't know if this is relevant, but when I had my first child, Bushman women give birth alone out in the bush for various reasons, and I was thinking of them. And they don't scream when they're giving birth or make any noise at all, because it would be very difficult. A predator could be attracted. And what would be more tempting than a woman in labor with a baby coming out? I mean, you can't make a noise. So I didn't make any noise when I was giving birth. I just ground my teeth, even though I did it without an anesthetic, because the anesthetist couldn't make the anesthetic, it was a spinal, and the anesthetist couldn't get the needle in my spine. So I did it, you know, like the Bushman did, without an anesthetic. And that was an interesting experience.
It sounds that way. What else did you take away from the worldview of the people there? I enjoyed all of the chapters about that, especially the part about, they had so few possessions. And then you talk about the possessions that you have just in your office and then your tool shed and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that contrast.
Well, a woman would have, wear a front apron and a back apron and a cape, that's three, and a string around her waist, that's four. She might have a couple of hair ornaments, that would be five and six. She'd have a digging stick, that would be seven. She would have an ostrich egg shell or two, which was empty and would use as a water container. That would be eight, nine, so that would be about it. And I am sitting at my desk right now and looking at least 200 things, counting the pencils, the files, the piles of paper. And that's my desk, let alone the room, let alone my house.
Such an amazing contrast.
Yeah.
I can imagine that one small fact alone would make you look at the world differently when you came back.
Yes, it would. I mean, I came to the conclusion that one person could own more things than all the people in Nyan Nyan put together.
Probably pretty easily.
But they didn't, you know, they had things. They had what they need. It came from the savannah. So they didn't need things.
And you also talk about the most important thing they had was the knowledge.
Oh, yes. Oh, phenomenal knowledge. And they were thought to be ignorant fools because they hadn't been to school. They knew every single thing in their environment. They could name every plant, every insect. They knew the insects by their qualities and also by their footprints. I went out with a young boy one time. He wanted to show me something, and it was a set of hyena tracks. And I said, gosh, I wonder when the hyena made the tracks. And he said, right after sunrise. And how did he know? Well, the tracks were crossed by the tracks of a dung beetle, and they can't move until the sun warms the air a little bit. So it was that's how we knew when it was. I mean, the observational skills were legendary. The arrow poison that came from a grub of a beetle that hangs around a certain kind of tree and lays its eggs on the leaves. The larva climb down under the bark. They go out of the tree through the roots. They make little pupa casings for themselves with sand, in the sand, about 3 feet deep. But they're the most deadly poison in the world, one of the most deadly poisons in the world. You can't, there's no antidote. If you're shot with an arrow poisoned with the poison, you die in a day, and something the size of a cow would die in 3 days. And it takes, the poison takes the hemoglobin and destroys the hemoglobin. So, and okay, how did they find it? Who would be digging under that tree? There's no food that grows there. Why would they dig 3 feet down under a tree where there was no reason to do that? But they did. Somebody did.
And how did they find it without killing themselves?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, how did they find it was poisonous? I don't know. I mean, you can eat when an animal is shot with the arrow. There's a blackish area around where the arrow hit, where the poison is still there, but you can eat that, and it won't hurt you because the poison has to enter your bloodstream, and it's just not known. Maybe, and even if you get some into your bloodstream, you don't die for a day. How do they know that? You know, but they did. They found out. Yeah. I mean, that shows the enormity of the kind of knowledge they had.
Yes. And you were already an observer of nature and of animals and animal behavior. How did learning from them or watching the Bushmen refine how you approached observation?
Well, I try to look at things more carefully and try to know what things are. But we don't need to know what things are. So I don't, I mean, I consider myself a naturalist, but I can't name every plant in the woods. I can name all the mammals and most of the birds, but certainly not all the insects. I mean, I know what kind of insect they are, but not what species.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll never catch up to anything like what they could do, but I could try. So.
Liz, referring to the title of your book, what does it mean to you to dream of lions?
Well, I have a recurring dream, and I like to have it. It's a little bit of an anxiety dream, but I dream that we live in New Hampshire, and I live in a house which was a farm with fields and woods. And the lions come out of the woods in the dream, and it's moonlight, so I can see them. And it's lionesses mostly, but sometimes there's a lion with them. But lionesses go together, and not always with a lion. But anyway, and they sort of stand around there, and I feel a little anxious in the dream because, you know, there are a lot of loose lions out there, and I'm not sure just what I should do. But nothing happens. I just watch them with caution, and they just interact with each other a little bit, and then the dream ends. But I love having it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it means something.
And what does it mean to you?
Well, I don't know yet.
You're still working on that.
Still working on that.
Have you had that dream ever since you returned from?
Well, I began having it maybe 10 years later or something. I don't know when, but quite a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have it often, but I do have the same dream over and over. And I think it has to do with moonlight, because lions don't hunt well when there's moonlight, because the prey can see them. They like the darkest nights. So maybe that, without my knowing it, that's a reassuring quality of the dream.
Huh. Yeah, that's fine.
Because I can see them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask about this. I saw that this book was originally released under the title A Million Years With You.
Yes.
And I was so moved by the story behind that title. Will you share it with our listeners?
Oh, yes. Well, my father and I, it was my father who introduced me to the natural world. My mother was an animal lover, and we had animals, and she was good to every kind of animal. But it was my father who liked to be in the woods and just really experience the natural world like that. And we used to go walking up the North Back, which is a nearby mountain, if you could call it a mountain. And we would talk about what it was like thousands of years ago when there was a glacier there. And we'd talk about that kind of thing. And we would talk about, he gave me the theory that the stream that flows by has molecules from dinosaurs in it. And he was aging, and he died maybe the next year after this happened. But we were talking about that, and he said, perhaps our molecules, after we're gone, could recombine or something like that. And he said, I'd like to live a million years with you. And then, because the molecules will keep going, he said, maybe we've done that already. So I treasure that remark.
I can see why. It's absolutely beautiful. Liz, before we let you go, one more question. I understand that you write all the time. What are you working on right now?
Well, I just finished a book called The Unknown World, and it's about the natural world and how little we know about it. But it traces evolutionary history, as it were, from bacteria up through the bushman, and how the natural world is pretty much lost to us. But there's life on other planets, so I thought we could send a message to the other planets saying, I mean, I have a cousin who's an astronomer, and he points out that there are, at the very minimum, 1 billion other planets in the universe that could sustain life. And if we found one where the conditions were right and was sustaining life, we could send them a message. And if we send it when their fish come out of the water, they'll get it when the human types come down out of the trees. And we can say, do as we say, but not as we do. We can tell them that.
What a great idea. I know some people find the idea of life on other planets threatening, but I find it very comforting.
I do too.
Because it makes me feel less responsible.
Yes, I know. If our planet goes, oh well. There's a billion others.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Liz. It's been really delightful.
And thank you. Yeah.
All the best with your book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.